Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hello, I'm Jos Verstappen, and you're listening to Beyond the Grid.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Grid, presented by the new Bose noise-cancelling headphones 700. I'm Tom Clarkson, and joining me this week is a driver from the Netherlands who caused a major stir when he jumped in an F1 car for the first time. So much so that everyone wanted his signature. Does that sound familiar? Well, no, I'm not talking about Max Verstappen, but his father, Jos. Some 25 years ago, Jos had the same meteoric rise through the junior formulas as his son. Like Max, he jumped straight from Formula 3 into Formula 1 via a hugely impressive debut test that made the front pages of every motorsport publication. Unlike Max, however, Jos's debut season was something of a baptism of fire, quite literally, in fact, as he went up against the great Michael Schumacher at Benetton. In all, Jos raced for six teams during his 10-year Formula One career, the highlight of which was a couple of podiums in 1994. Would things have panned out differently for him had he not gone up against the best driver of his generation? Possibly. But you sense when speaking to Jos that his racing career was a mere fact-finding mission ahead of perhaps his ultimate destiny, which was helping prepare his son Max for greatness. For all you racing dads out there, this would appear to be the blueprint of how to make a success of your son's career. I sat down with Jos at the recent Belgian Grand Prix, where fans supporting his son packed out Spa-Francorchamps. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Jos, welcome to Beyond the Grid. Lovely to see you. Now, many people know you these days as Max's dad, but you were, of course, a very, very good racing driver in your own right. And you arrived on the scene with a load of hype about you. Do you remember all that? Does it feel like yesterday?
No, it doesn't definitely not feel like yesterday. No, I did. I mean, I think the first test I did in Formula One, it was in Estoril. That went pretty well, and I think that's created a lot of hype.
Well, I think you set a time good enough for 10th on the grid the day before at the Grand Prix or something.
No, day after. I think we were testing on the Tuesday morning after the race. I mean, I had no clue how a Formula One car would react or how fast it was. So I had to adapt because I came out of Formula 3 and the difference were huge. And then at the end of the day, I did a good lap time and it put me 10th on the grid or something. And I was about 3/10 faster than the drivers who were racing that year.
But I mean, let's talk about some of that momentum because German Formula 3 champion, you'd won the Marlboro Masters at Zandvoort. And then, I mean, is it true that every Formula One team contacted you except for Ferrari and Williams? Did everybody else get in touch?
Yeah, I mean, I tested with Footwork. We had contact with, most of them. I think after the test, I did one day of testing with McLaren in Silverstone. We had contact with Eddie Jordan, Flavio. Yeah, a lot of people.
So Flavio Briatore, why did you choose Benetton?
Because they guarantee me the year after. That's why we choose for them.
Crikey, how it all panned out.
And then later in the first test, he had an accident and he broke his neck.
JJ later. Yeah.
So, and then I took over all the testing and they put me in the car and beginning onwards.
Now, were you ready for that first race of 94?
No, absolutely not. And then next to Michael, what was not maybe the best choice. But I wasn't. I mean, when I compare it with how they prepare the drivers now, I definitely was not ready for that. But
I mean, if you look back, where were you lacking? Because you had the raw pace. You'd proved that in the junior formulas. You'd proved that in that footwork test at Estoril. So
I think physically I was not up to it. Experience, nothing. And then during the years, you get your experience, but you made your mistakes already. And there was nobody next to me who could help me with that. And that I think played a big part. Once you had a chance in the top team and you're not performing, I think you will face a very difficult career.
I mean, how much did that first race at Estoril, at Interlagos, affect your confidence? Because you remember, was it contact with Eddie Irvine?
Yeah, I mean, I think Eddie didn't see me, but then there was the contact, so I spun. But I had never had a problem with that. I wasn't ever scared it didn't hurt my confidence at all.
So then we go to AIDA. I think you spun there.
Spun after the pistol.
So kind of after two races, Leto comes back. And where are you at mentally at this point? What are you thinking about Formula One? What are you thinking about your relationship with Benetton?
I was still good, I think. I think JJ came back in Imola. I think it was fourth or fifth race, I think. Can't remember really. But it didn't hurt my confidence. But I was still, I was still trying. Every time I was trying to match Michael's pace. And it never stopped me not trying and not worrying about going off or what was bad for your career. But I kept trying all the time.
I mean, let's talk about Michael Schumacher then. I mean, it was still early on in his career, but what are your memories of him and where was he so darn good?
Obviously, he got in the car and immediately he's fast. I mean, I think he was stronger. He was working flat out off track. And he knew what he was doing. And I think physically, I wasn't up to the game,
Do you feel he politically had the team more on his side?
Yeah, 100%.
And by that, I mean Flavio, I mean everybody.
Yeah, all was focused on him. Of course, he was winning the races and he was going for the championship.
Do you feel...
I understand. But
you understand that?
Yeah, I understand. But and then, after the accident of Ayrton and Imola, then there was a lot of rule changes to the team with the step floor and things like that. So all the testing went into that, to help me to get the confidence in the car, to make me move faster. Not like it is today, they really help the other driver who is struggling. But at that time, they didn't care.
And of course, you mentioned Senna. He got out of the car in AIDA. He spun out as well.
Yeah, I know.
And he came out with this pretty explosive comment saying that he thought the Benettons had traction control. What's your take on that now?
I definitely didn't have it. Yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah.
Of course, I know all the rumors and things, but I cannot prove anything. But one thing I can say, I didn't have it.
Yeah. And then we go to, Hockenheim. There was the fire covered in flames. Yeah, scary was
spun that? Spun off from Michael's car on Friday qualifying.
God. So, in Michael's car, did you say?
Yeah, because mine broke. Michael went out in his car and I went on a Friday, spun off in qualifying. So that was not a good weekend for me.
But what are your memories of the fire? How scary was it?
Of course, I remember, coming in and then you see the fluid. Of course, it is fuel, but at that time, you think, you don't know what to expect. I always opened the visor because I needed the fresh air. And then the fire went all dark and you can't breathe when you're in the middle of it. And so I was looking for the steering wheel to get off. I think in six seconds, it was the put out the fire and I was standing up in the car at that time. But the best place where it can happen was in the pit lane, of course. With all the fire extinguishers and people
did you
around.
Feel any anger towards the team?
No, I didn't. I didn't mind, to be honest. We are racing as dangerous. It was fine to me.
And how much damage to you, your skin? I mean, burns and
I had little burns on my nose, under my eyes, under my eyebrows.
Where you'd that had was, that was the all visor open. Damn it!
Because I had the visor open, and I think a little bit of the. I think it's the heat what burned a little bit.
But that was it. Hands
that
were okay.
Yeah, all fine.
And given what you went through then, would you welcome the return to refueling in Formula One now?
I don't mind, to be honest. I think when it's good for the sport, when it's good for the races, I think everybody would welcome it. But I don't know. It's hard to judge for me if it should come back, yes or no.
From a safety point of view, you wouldn't have
it? I don't think it's makes that much difference those days.
Well, I'll tell you what, you bounce back from that disappointment with those podiums. Well, we had Hungary and...
I finished on the podium, but I don't know...
What was the overriding emotion?
I don't know if you can say I bounce back. I just finished fourth or third, but then the last lap, Brundle broke down his McLaren, so I overtook him. So that was a little bit luck, but sometimes...
How did it feel? What was the overriding emotion when you...
It was good. I mean, with all the struggle I had, and, you know, it was a tough time, but that was just very welcome on the right moment.
What did Flavio say to you?
I was happy. You could see when I came into the pit lane and he was there with Michael, you could see that he was happy for me. But I must say, I always had a good relationship with Flavio, every time.
So when he said to you, Jos, we're going to stand you down for the last couple of races and we're going to bring in Johnny Herbert.
It was Johnny at the end of 94. Yeah, I just accepted it. But then, you know, after the year, he helped me to go to another team. He helped me to go into the Simtek with Nick Ward. I mean, it wasn't a bad car. In one occasion, Argentina was on the sixth position in the race somewhere. And then, you know, but in 98, he put me back in the test team with Benetton. So he kind of looked after me a little bit.
Was he straightforward to deal with?
I'm not sure about that question.
But the memories are good, but, you know, I mean, okay, Jos, do you regret... You had the whole of the Formula One paddock after you at the end of 93. Do you regret that you ended up in a Benetton and not somewhere else?
Yeah, I think when you look back at it, yes, I should have made a different choice. Maybe I should have gone to a smaller team, learn from your mistakes, and then try to come up to a better team. I think that's a logical step, and not step into a top team straight away.
You needed your time at Toro Rosso. To put a modern-day equivalent on it.
Like that, yeah. I think 1 or 2 years in a smaller team to learn, to understand what it's all about in Formula One, and then, yeah, the way up.
Was it difficult to pick yourself up after that year?
Not really. I mean, I still have belief in myself, yeah.
But did you think it was going to be harder from there? You knew what you were up against, both in terms of...
Not at that moment. I think I still believe, you know, it's not the end of the world. I think I still could do it. But then during my career, definitely at the end of it, I really thought, you know, that's it. You don't come up. You know, it was a tough route. And then with Arrows and with Tyrrell, you know, and that's where... And then I think the last year I was done with it. I couldn't do it anymore.
When you're with the Minardi?
That you not go, you know, go to a race weekend and have a chance of winning or podium or whatever. I couldn't do it anymore. So I said I stopped with it. I'm done.
So, but in the mid-90s then, after that Benetton period, when you were bouncing between Simtek, Arrows, Tyrrell, as you say, Stewart, were there any highlights? I mean...
Some races, I think, but at that time the reliability was not there. You know, a lot of races you didn't finish, and it was not like racing like today. You know, where you have a lot of reliability, but at that time, at that period, it was definitely not.
But did you get a kick out of just being in Formula One, driving a Formula One car?
I think driving at the speed, the qualifying—that's what you really enjoy. The racing, I like racing. But then it was not a lot to compete to.
Well, do you know, I remember the first Grand Prix I ever came to in a working capacity was Spa 1996. And I think one of the first cars I ever saw was your Arrows after... Didn't a wishbone fail?
No, it was a wheel hub failure.
Absolutely massive accident. Yeah,
that was a big accident.
There was nothing left of the car. No.
I came in the lap before, the throttle was stuck. So I had straight into the pit lane. They checked everything. No, everything is fine. Went out again and then that lap into where the go-kart track is. I don't know that right
sort
hand
of Stavelo,
corner.
Is it? Stavelo.
Yeah, yeah. I went straight on, flat out. That was a big accident.
Did you hurt your neck? I think.
Oh yeah.
Hurt everything. I would imagine.
So yeah, everything. I think I was knocked out, and then I got up and walk again, and then knock out again. So I went to a hospital here in Liège, and then the first thing I said, I don't want to drive anymore. That was my first reaction. But then I think a couple of hours later, you know, you were thinking to go out again. So, but my first reaction was, oh, stop it.
Was that, that was like...
That the, was really...
Was that the biggest crash of...
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
It was, well, we're still here.
It was...
so it's good.
Now, look, what about the Dutch fans? We were talking about Spa, and of course, you're here with your boy now, and the whole place, in fact, not just here, pretty much all of the European tracks turn orange.
Yeah.
How was it for you? What was your relationship like with the Dutch fans?
Also quite good. I think at the time we had the biggest fan club.
Yeah,
we had a lot of members, a lot of Dutch fans show up at the races. But it was a big hype, but nothing like it is now with Max. So it's
where did the Jos the Boss thing start? Can you remember? What, that was that a Dutch fan?
I don't know who called me that. And I don't know. I really don't know. I know that. We had
but it was on flags.
Yeah,
was...
we had the fan club, and we brought out a magazine every 3 months, and that was called Jos de Bos. So, and that were all, you know, we didn't have the Instagram and Twitter and things like that. So we did everything by, we sent the fans posters and then the magazine and things like that. That was our communication to the fans.
I mean, given that Max cannot move when he goes back to Holland now. What was it like for you? Were you still living there? Or
I was popular as well in Holland, but I lived in Monaco in the beginning of my career, and then later on I lived in Belgium. So it was, for me, it was okay. But with Max's popularity now, they also remember me more, so I have a bit of the same problem. Not as much as Max, of course, but the people know me, yeah.
So look, we go, Stuart was 98, but then something a really meaty topic I want to talk to you about was the Honda F1 project. In 99, you did a lot of testing for them. What was being said to you about Honda coming in with the works team? What was on the cards at the time?
That Honda would come in Formula One again with their own team. So we had a deal with them, first year testing, and if they would join Formula One as a race team, I would be one of the drivers.
And that was all written down?
It was in the contract.
And so how good was that test car? I mean...
It was good. I mean, Harvey was the leader in that, and we had some good, very good design. Tim Densham and some other good guys from Tyrrell. They went, a lot of them went there to Dallara to building it. So we had a lot of good people around. Steve Nielsen, team manager, and so a lot of people were still around here. They were in that Honda project. So I really enjoyed it because the car was good, was fast, and then everybody was thinking that we were running underweight, but we couldn't. I mean, it was on the limit, but we were never underweight. But it was just very good.
And did you think, finally, after this topsy-turvy career I've had, I'm onto a good thing here, and I'm going to win?
That was the plan. But then after a couple of months, I think Harvey knew already that it was going in the wrong direction. Still remembering when it happened with Harvey. I was with Steve Nielsen in the trailer when Harvey came in. He had a very strange color on his face, and it was...
Can I say, so this is at, you're at a test session?
Yeah, test session.
Harvey Postlethwaite's the man we're talking about. Was he team principal, or is that...
He was leading the project. Yeah.
Okay, leading the project. So you're at a test session, and he comes into the truck, and you
that
say...
That was after the first day.
Where are we at, Jerez or Barcelona?
Barcelona. So I was talking to Steve, and Harvey came in, and he looked a bit grey, and, you know, was... But Harvey was a brilliant and very nice person. But he was complaining, you know, touching his, a little bit pain. And so I looked to Steve, and I said, go, you know, and then... They came into the hotel and Harvey collapsed. Yeah, that was very emotional, very difficult. And that was also the last time we were out on track.
What did you hear from Honda after that? Was it an immediate end to the program?
Yeah, I don't know. Did we go out another time? And then there was a guy coming from Honda and they say that was it. You know, we pack up and we go.
Jos, you're not the first person who's talked to me about Harvey Postlethwaite and spoken so affectionately about him. I mean, for people who don't know, he had so much history in the sport with Ferrari.
I don't know his career, of course, but I worked with him at Tyrrell. And I just, you know, we just had a click. Just was a nice human being, very clever. It's good to work with, very motivated. Was a very good person.
And was that the final blow for your career as well? Do you think? Did you see that as your last chance?
Yeah, no, not last chance. And then we went to Arrows. You know, we had some good results there. And then Tom was very motivated.
Oh my goodness, talk to me about Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah, well, that's a long story. And so he gave me a chance. We had some good races, but Tom, of course.
Leafield, the place where the team was based, had great facility, wasn't it?
It was big. They had a lot of facilities, but we didn't have the results what we wanted.
Was that the Sergio Rinland era when he was there making the car?
I think that was in the beginning. I think he left when I came in, and that was 2000, I think.
Right.
So,
So there was Tom Walkinshaw, and then you had, we've talked about Flavio. What about Jackie Stewart at the studio?
I worked with him because I took over from Magnussen in 98. I think first race was Magny-Cours, but then, the team had their issues with the reliability. I think the gear was the big problem. It was okay, but not. I think the team was really concentrated on Barrichello. I mean, I got along with him very well, but we had a lot of problems there. But was still good.
Technical or otherwise?
Technical. Yeah. Technical. Yeah. And with Jackie, was okay to work with.
And then, damn it, in 99, they actually came out with a good car, didn't they? And they, Johnny Herbert won that race, and Nürburgring.
In the wet. Yeah, that's correct. But then I had a Honda project that looked very, very good as well. So, bit unlucky sometimes, but
I mean, that's the question, isn't it? How do you reflect on it all now? Because I still remember the hype at the end of 93. And I look at you now and think, I cannot believe that man only scored, what is it? Two podiums what was it, 17?
I'm happy with all what happened, of course, but especially now how Max is doing, you know, and one hand, it is okay to me. I have no regrets, or I'm not, you know, angry about things. Of course, when you had to do it again, I would have done it differently.
What would you have done differently?
No, I mean, prepare yourself better, the choices we made and things like that, you know, physically, you know, have a proper trainer, you know, build it up and things like that. But I think, you know, it was all good for me. I made money, and then after 2003, I stopped and I put all my effort in the guy who was racing now. So it all worked out for us.
We'll hear more from Jos in a moment, but first, here's some shaving advice. If you want the best quality shave for half the price of other brands out there, then make sure you go to harrys.com/F1podcast to get your hands on a trial set for just £3.95. And here's a little factoid about our friends at Harry's. There are 600 engineers, designers, craftsmen and chemists at their factory in Germany working hard and making products with only the finest materials and ingredients to ensure you get the smoothest shave possible. And getting your hands on a trial set couldn't be easier to arrange. Just enter your details online and you'll get a package delivered to your door with all you need to get going, including a weighted ergonomic handle ensuring maximum comfort and grip while you shave, and 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade. My handle came in a vivid orange colour, papaya orange, McLaren orange, you might say, but you can also choose from olive or navy. You'll also get a foaming shave gel to keep your skin looking good and a handy little travel blade cover to protect your kit. So that's a kit with a value of £11.50 for just £3.95. So get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you including a razor handle, five-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/F1podcast. That's harrys.com/F1podcast. Now let's get back to Jos. So what, Max was born in 1997, wasn't he? So you're at Tyrrell at the time. I mean, let's talk about the lad then. I mean, first things first, how often did he come to races with you? I mean, was like the first thing he ever saw almost was a racing car or?
Yeah, I mean, we're still, so he was 97. So I think when he was 3 years old, it was 2000. I was racing in Arrows. Sometime, yeah, I brought him to the track. And
I think I've seen photos of him in the cockpit.
Exactly. Yeah, and then when we go testing, I took him with me, only him and me. And then somebody of the team was, when I was driving, was looking after him and things like that. So that's quite funny. But obviously, you know, it was always about racing. I think when we were having food, or it was all about racing. So I think he's brought up with it.
And then given that Mum Sophie's very good kart racer, isn't she? It's kind of, he was only ever going to do one thing. Is that fair?
Yeah, but you never know, you know, the interest of a little boy. So, but he was keen. He was watching all the races. He was always very sad when I was leaving, because he knew I was leaving because of my job and driving. He was always crying when I left home. And so he was really hanging on to me when he was very little. So he was watching it all the time. He knew what was going on. And we had a go-kart team at home. My dad ran it. And so he was always on racing tracks. And he was always watching and looking. And, you know, so he's brought up with racing, that's for sure.
Was there anything else that he could have done? Was there anything else he was particularly good at from a sporting point of view?
He played football, but I cannot say he was particularly good at it. He was trying, that's for sure. You could see when he was small, his balance was very good. The way he was running, bicycling, you know, he had a very, very good balance all the time.
And what kind of a kid was he? Was he a gentle kid?
Yeah.
Was he?
Yeah, very gentle. Very good, very normal.
And what about his siblings? Any of, you know, he's the only Verstappen, baby Verstappen that we talk about. But of course he's got, what is it, how many, what are his siblings he's got?
Yeah, he has a sister.
She's good, isn't she? She's quick, I've heard.
Yeah, we did some go-kart, but I must say, I concentrated on him for racing. Because he lived also, because I split up, and Max was living with me, and Victoria was living with her mum. Because we were always away, so that's why he was living with me. We were always racing.
Yeah.
And so I've always stayed in contact with my daughter every day. I was calling her and talking, you know.
What's her thing? What's Victoria's thing? Does she have a particular interest
passion? She likes racing. She likes fashion. So she's designing her own clothing with, you know, the lion what Max has on his helmet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Unleash the Lion she's doing. So, yeah, she likes it and she likes the racing.
And so can you describe the moment when you realised Max really had something, You knew he wasn't just good, he was very good.
That was quite early on when he was in a go-kart. I think we realised it already when he was around 7.
But what stood out? What was it that made him
racecraft.
Different?
When he goes out for a race on cold tires, his first lap was always a second quicker than anybody else. So when he had the lead in turn one after the start, the first time he came over start and finish, he had a second lead. And then they're running on colder tires. He has and for me, that's talent, that's feeling, and that's what you also see in the wet, you know, when you have very little grip, that's where he is fast.
And so what I'm finding fascinating is that some people might think that you had to push him into racing, but that's not the impression I'm getting. He was self-motivated.
He was very interesting in it. He wanted to start very early. He was always, I want to, you know, he said, yeah, when you were a little bit older, then I knew then I had more time for him as well. But then, you know, you get your go-kart on a beer. And my plan was to put him in a go-kart when he's 6 years old. He was with his mom on a go-kart track in Genk nearby our house. And then he called me, Daddy, I want to go. And he was crying. And because he saw a younger guy running, and I want to do it as well. So, and then when I came home, I remember I was in Canada for the race. So when I came home from Canada, I bought him a go-kart. So, and that's how it started. He was four and a half.
And did you coach him? Were you having to tell him where to brake, teach him the lines?
Not in the beginning. Just let him have fun and drive. But I really never had to tell him the racing lines or things like that. He knew because he was watching all the time.
And so here's the $10 million question. Is he better than you?
Much better than me.
No, seriously.
He's much better.
Where is he better than you?
I had talent. But I think the whole way he's brought up, teached, I think that makes him a lot better.
I kind of get the impression, and tell me if I'm wrong, that your racing career was all...
helped to
exactly
make his racing career.
Is that how you see it?
No, yeah, really. That's how I see it. Yeah.
And that taught you the pitfalls that you fell in because you didn't know better.
I learned a lot from my career. You learn the most from your mistakes you make. And I looked in the mirror. I know exactly what I've done wrong or didn't do right. And I tried to, you know, to teach him only the good things.
And was he always receptive? I mean,
yeah,
I've got children. I know that.
No, but he had so much faith in me because I was always on track and I was telling things, teaching things. And there was never any question that he didn't have trust in me. Still now, I think when I see things happening, we always speak. He's older now. He's real. For me, he's a real man. He understands what he's doing. But we listen to each other. And he listens.
Even now.
He listens how I see it. He tells me how he see it. And we don't have to agree. But I know him that he really thinks about what I'm saying. Because I'm here not to destroy him, but to help him. And that's how he looked at me.
But at what level are you discussing? Are you talking big picture career decisions?
Anything,
will he say,
life.
Dad, I'm really struggling with that corner?
I mean, life,
anything.
It's racing, it's private, it's everything. And that's the good thing we have, you know. We have a good... We have the distance because he has his own life, he has his own friends, but we know each other. And we understand...
Would you say you're hands-on now, or are you hands-off?
Hands-off. And sometimes hands-on, when it needs to. When I see things, I wouldn't say go wrong or not going in the right direction, then I tell him.
You're obviously seeing his career right from the inside. I'm looking at it from the outside, and I see a huge change in him midway through last year, 2018.
Yeah.
Would you agree? Is that fair?
I mean, when you look at the results and the accidents he doesn't have anymore, yes. But he didn't change that much. And I think 2018 just didn't fall in his hands. You know, it always fell on the wrong side. Maybe a little bit too greedy. Maybe they expected too much. You know, they really wanted to go...
They, the team? Or?
Also him. Not only the team. They wanted to go for the World Championship. Not quick enough, and I may be overdriving, over pushing it a little bit too much, because if you cannot qualify in the first row to win a race, it's hard. So when you qualify fourth, fifth, you have to take more risk. And if you don't have the speed on the straights, you have to take even bigger risk to overtake. And I think this is what happened. He took too big risk to get past.
That's his sort of on track demeanor, but I also mean off track. He speaks, I cannot believe he's only 21. He speaks with the maturity and authority and the gravitas of someone 10 years older.
But he was always there when I giving interviews. At the time, I still had a lot of interviews, and I always did it, you know, invited him where I had my workshop, Max was always listening. He didn't say anything, but he was there. The journalist asked, but he understood, of course. And I think at the end, it has taught him something. So probably is that, I don't know.
I feel
And I think also Max is, he understands. He understands the world and he's clever. He really knows what's going on.
Just actually, let's talk about his cleverness in terms, because you were always on the road, from a schooling point of view, what actually happened there
in school?
Yeah,
I think afterward I heard more stories than he was at the school. He was good. He was a good student, but of course we were away a lot, so he lost out a lot of the time. But he still had the good points. I think he
was diligent. Was he?
He didn't like it at all. He didn't want to go to school. It was always every day. It was a fight to bring him to school. Yeah, but then it worked out for him.
My goodness, it did, didn't it?
Yeah.
How much has Max's success changed your life?
I think it changed our whole family's life, of course. In the last 5 years, it changed a lot. I mean, I have more time now for my private life, what I didn't have the last 25 years. So it changed Max's life a lot. It changed my daughter's life a lot. It changed his mum. It changed everything. Things, yeah. I mean, we are here, you know, working with Raymond, his manager, and me, we make the decisions. We always talk. We always have a conversation to, you know, every deal, everything, we always discuss together. And I think Max, Raymond and me, we go along very well. And this is so good to have the right people in the right place.
And, you know, I look at another driver who, equally talented, Lewis Hamilton, he felt, God, it's something like 10 years ago now, but he felt he needed to break away from the paternal influence, the father. Can you ever envisage a day when you and Max don't work together?
I think we will not come to that point that he thinks that way, because I really leave him. I let him do his own things, but I always have my ears open and things like that. And also, you know, I'm not there to do only the complaining or, Max, you shouldn't do that. No, also tell him what is good. And we also have Raymond in place. He speaks with him. You know, we have a very good relationship also in private.
And how about your relationship with Christian Horner, Helmut Marko, the big cheeses at Red Bull?
It's very good. We never have issues. And I think also it's because we're straightforward. We say what we think. I think with Helmut and us, we never have an issue, never. Because he also have feels that we understand what we are doing here.
He says it as it is, doesn't he, old Helmut?
Yeah, but that's how we are as yes. well. So,
yeah.
And if the driver does well, it makes your life a little bit easier with Helmut, of course.
Of course it is.
It's normal. Yeah. It's that way, because he's also here to win. You know, now, he's not here to finish second.
It's interesting, while we're talking about Red Bull, do you remember, so you came in at the end of 93, had lots of offers, ended up with a championship winning team. When Max was in F3, you had everybody wanting you. What was it about Red Bull that made you jump that way?
He offered us to race for Toro Rosso.
That was the main thing. It was because a guarantee, you know, of a race seat. Yeah.
You know how difficult it is to get into Formula One. So when he offered that, I said immediately, okay, we don't do it for 1 year, we go for 2 years. You know, first year is learn, and second year we do a proper job.
Were you at all nervous? I mean, given that you actually said a little bit earlier that you probably weren't quite ready for that race drive
I
in 94.
But I knew Max was.
Just because his preparation leading up to it.
Yeah, I mean, his raw speed, the maturity he has, and also, to be honest, it's the way Red Bull picked him up and trained him and things like that. Simulate, you know, they really put all effort to make it a success.
Mm. And his age, or lack of it, did that worry you?
No. For me, it was never about age or no. I mean, definitely not after his first test in Formula One. And anyway, it was an older car. He had to do 300 clicks, and he jumped in, and it was so natural what he was doing, because I was standing on top to overview the whole track, and it was impressive what he was doing for the first time in a race in Formula One car.
And that gave you the confidence to say, son, go for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what about you two racing together? The whole of Holland, I think a few people from Holland might listen to this, want to see the two of you together. Will it ever happen, a Le Mans or a...
No, I don't think so.
Have you hung up your helmet for good?
I wouldn't say so, but more on a hobby basis, I think. I mean, I'm doing drive some cars, but just for fun now. I haven't raced for 9 years, I think.
Do you miss it?
No, because Max gives me the adrenaline, you know, to the excitement.
Does he really?
Yeah, I mean, as a dad, I think it's the most exciting to have your son racing, more than driving yourself.
For instance, when you're on the grid before the start of a race, yeah. watching him, is yeah. your heart rate...
Much higher than I was racing myself.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely, I'm sure. It's exciting. It's, you know, you want to, yeah, that he does well. And but when I was racing, and I always had like, you know, I do my best, I do all I can, you know, and that's it. And I was calm. I wasn't nervous. But with him there, and always, you know, I know how he races, and he has to take a little bit more risk to come to the front. You know, it's exciting. And Max is an exciting driver.
And are you pleased, well, you must be pleased, but how do you assess his 2019 season so far? Because he's had to step up. He's become the number one and he's been very seamless from where I'm.
Yeah, he's doing really well. But he also points out immediately what is good and bad. You know, he's very, for him, it's easy to feel what is working and not. And that's what the team likes as well. But also... he feels that he has performed now because he's the main guy and he has to bring the points home. And that's what he's doing.
And when he won that Grand Prix in Austria with Honda...
Yeah, that was
did good. That give you, because of what happened in 99 and Harvey's death and things, was there sort of an element of unfinished business there that he was able to close that chapter for you and win a race with Honda?
No, I wasn't thinking about that. But I really, really enjoyed it for the... Honda people, because they went through such a difficult time with McLaren and it was so good. And then when Max stepped onto the podium, when he pointed to the Honda logo on his overall, and that was never talked about it before, that was just his, you know, he also had the same feeling, you know. And then seeing the Japanese in the garage, they, you know, they had tears in their eyes, and then you could see how much it does with those people, how much heart and effort and they put in the whole thing, and that was unbelievable.
Are any of the Honda guys in the pit lane now from when you were there? Are any of the same faces?
Yeah, maybe one or two, but I really can't remember. I mean, my memory is probably not as good anymore, but I think there was.
So do you think Red Bull Honda are on the right path?
They're definitely on the right path, you can see.
No, but enough to see Max Verstappen commit to the team in the longer term, do you
think? Well, we have a contract with them for 2020. Yeah. And I mean, they want. I mean, they're working flat out, and the team wants. You know, we want to win. We don't want to finish second. So everybody is in the same direction. So we will see what's happening for next year. It's an important year for everybody, I guess.
And is it lost on you the fact that you're he's kind of racing for the team that you race for?
It's a Stewart.
Yes,
isn't it?
Mind you, the factory's changed.
I said,
a
also
bit,
Toro
right?
Rosso I raced for. So
yeah, you did actually. It's with Minardi, of course. Yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels.
It changed a little bit. Nah, it's good. I mean, I like Red Bull team. It's fantastic to be in. It's young, it's dynamic, it's friendly, it's a lot of fun. If you see the mechanics, it's really nice.
Well, Jos, it's been wonderful to talk to you. I suppose final thoughts from me are: how do you reflect on your life so far? I mean, first of all, the racing career, when you look back at that Formula One career, how do you reflect on it?
At the end, I think it's good. My own career, of course, I think it could have gone a lot better if we made different choices, but you cannot turn it back. You know, you make your choice at the moment when you have the information what you have at that moment. So we did. But I'm very happy because of what I did. I gave it to my son, and now this is all happening to us. So, yeah, I'm a happy man, absolutely.
And would you rather, this might seem an odd question, but would you almost rather be having the success with Max than you having it yourself
absolutely.
20 years ago?
Absolutely.
Why is that, do you think?
I think you want to have the best for your children. You know, I had my good things. I enjoyed it. I had fun in Formula One. I made money in Formula One, you know, and that gave us what we have now.
Yeah. Well, it's great to chat to you. Let's hope lots more Verstappen success in the future.
We'll be there. I'm sure about that.
Thanks for your time.
Okay. Cheers. Thank you.
That's how you do it, racing dads. Have your own F1 career, learn from your mistakes, and ensure your son doesn't do the same. Easy, eh? Perhaps that helps explain why so many racing sons go on to become top drivers themselves. There were some great stories in that chat, but Jos only truly came alive when talking about Max, who he is clearly immensely proud of, and rightly so. It was fascinating to hear his thoughts on Schumacher, Briatore and the rest, but you sense that Jos only likes to look forward now, and the future is Max. It was great to catch up, Jos. Thanks for your time. Well, that's it for this episode, but before we go, a big thanks for all your feedback on last week's episode with Alex Albon. You had a lot to say about him, and there appears to be a lot of love out there for the young Red Bull driver. This message from Abayomi on Twitter stood out. That was by far the most refreshing and human episode of F1 Beyond the Grid yet. Alex Albon has gone through a lot at such a young age, yet he's still steely behind those calm eyes. You sense he's ready for whatever life brings next. He's here to stay. Well, it really looks like that, doesn't it, Abayomi? Alex is modest, unassuming, and he's been through a lot to get to this point. I wish him every success in the future. So please keep your feedback coming. We love it. Remember to use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid, and you can tweet me at TomClarksonF1. We'll be back next week with another big name from the world of F1. Until then, why not subscribe to the show on your favourite podcast app and leave us a review. Both help us enormously. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audio Boom. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.